Would that mean if you were a clerical person working at the Court of Appeals, you couldn't be in a collective bargaining unit because you're exempt?
No, doesn't mean that at all. It merely says that they will be under the same system as the trial court employees, which is the way they are. We have one personnel system with everybody classified. You know, judicial assistants, bailiffs are classified the same way in the trial courts as the appellate courts. And this basically talks about bailiffs.
It says here they're not subject to ORS Chapter 240.
That's right, because that talks about exempt and unclassified, but has, in terms of the executive system, has nothing to do with collective bargaining. I don't know how to, I'm not going to convince you, I can tell right now, but this is, has to do with bringing people under the personnel system, the appellate courts. The issue in collective bargaining is the trial courts, not the appellate courts.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pryor.
This thing uses the term, on line 17, employees of the state court administrator. Are those,
it's my staff.
I'm trying to figure out whether the clerk or what the people you can call clerks that work in the circuit courts.
They're not in the state court administrator's office. They're in the trial courts. It's the case records.
Well, I know, but they're certainly not employees of the trial court. Who are they employees of, I guess is my question.
The trial court clerks?
Yeah.
They're employees of the state court system. They're state employees.
Okay. And by, so that would not be included then within the employees of the state court administrator then?
No, the state court administrator has a very small staff that does basically the appellate records for the Court of Appeals, Supreme Court, and Tax Court, and then does the personnel and financial system for the court system as a whole. But the trial courts, the people, for example, who are working in the Lane County Court are not on my staff.
Yeah. Okay. They're employees of the state court system, but not of the state court administrator.
Administrator, right. That's correct.
Okay. What about a secretary to a Supreme Court justice? Would that be covered by, would she or he be covered by Chapter 27, Section 27?
No. We're not. Section 27.
Are they employees?
Officers and
yes.
Employees of the mm-hmm. Supreme Court.
That's right. What this
who
does,
are
section
appointed under personal.
Section 27 takes the appellate court employees and puts them with the same status as trial court employees, and the fact that they are under the personnel system and have the same rights regarding to appeal and grievance. That last line is the same as in this House Bill 3292 in regard to trial court employees. Makes,
well,
the two, makes one system is what it does.
Senator Fry gets appointed to the Supreme Court, and well, what protections do people have under the personnel plan established by the Chief Justice?
In regard to what?
Oh, seniority, for example.
Well, I guess I have to answer that by saying we have a standard set of personnel rules, which includes classification, compensation, vacation time, sick leave, overtime, grievance, appeals board.
If you're a secretary to a Supreme Court justice and that justice retires, do you get to keep that job as
yes.
secretary?
Under the existing system.
Existing since when?
January 1. Because personnel rules weren't in effect until January 1. We didn't have a state court system until January 1. So the personnel system that was mandated by statute for the Chief Justice to put in place on January 1 is the rules that I'm talking about, which would allow a secretary to keep the position, or anybody else who's, to make a difference, whether you're a secretary or a court operations specialist one. You, during good behavior, so to speak, or unless somebody files a grievance against you, you keep the job. You can only be fired for due cause, so to speak. That's the last line. However, such personnel have the right to dismiss only for just cause after hearing an appeal. And that's what brings them in the same, puts them in the same status as the trial court employees. And that's provided for in the rules, the grievance and discipline procedure in the appeal board.
Which then allows them to come under collective bargaining if they wish to as a
right.
base of the last court decision.
Right. It puts everybody in exactly the same status. Right now they aren't.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hendricks.
What does the word exempt service mean then?
You'd have to ask the executive branch. The exempt and unclassified. I don't have the definition. Does anybody have the statute?
It's in Chapter 240.
240. I didn't bring it with me.
They file on individual management
So even the anybody that works in the office, you're saying employee does not mean the clerical.
I'm sorry, what line are you in?
She said it does mean.
It does mean. They are considered exempt also.
No. Exempt status means personal consultants, or depending on how your budget comes, the executive rules on certain
positions. Reading the bill. It says officers, employees of state, Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, Tax Court, employees of state court administrators who are appointed, so on and so forth, are state officers, employees in exempt service.
Okay, that puts them in the same, at the same basis as the trial court employees, which by 3292 were put in the exempt service. I don't have the bill handy, but that's what it is.
Well, I'm looking under definitions in 240. I don't see exempt service used.
It's there somewhere.
Now, you say that the House Bill 3292 is the one that deals with the state court employees.
That's the one that brought the trial court employees under state funding and mandated that the Chief Justice set up a personnel system for court employees, and everybody thought that the Supreme Court, that it would include all employees, both Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, Tax Court, Circuit Court, and District Court, and we didn't realize that this was here, which did not allow one system for everybody. So what we're trying to do is give everybody the same status.
What's this?
This section 27, 28, and 30. Puts both the trial court and appellate court employees, puts them all in the same box. Right now, the box is not quite the same.
What was it that was there that kept you from doing that originally?
We went ahead and did it because we didn't realize the statute existed.
Exempt service is a definition. It says officers, 240-200, officers elected by popular vote, persons appointed to fill vacancies in elective office, members of boards and commissions who serve on a part-time basis, judges, referees, receivers, court reporters, bailiffs, officers of the court, juries, jurors and notaries public, officers and employees of the Legislative Assembly, and persons employed in a professional or scientific capacity to make or conduct temporary special inquiry, investigation, or examination on behalf of the Legislative Assembly or committee. And then there's one catch-all, any position designated by law is exempt. So they'd have our employees, which probably doesn't bode very well for the court employees.
Well, but she says they've adopted a personnel plan.
I didn't bring a copy of that, but I've got it.
Why is it you want them to be exempt?
The legislature decided they're exempt. We're not saying. What we want is for all the court employees to be exactly the same one as the other, and right now they aren't. The legislature decided that the trial court employees should be exempt. That's the way that reads. And what we want is for the appellate court employees to be in the same status as the trial court employees.
What bill is it that exempts the secretaries of trial court judges from these provisions?
It's a bill. It's ORS 8.235 that was passed by the 1981 special session.
Mm-hmm.
As part of that package, this language is picks up the language from that.
It says listing off.
It's still hard to know in terms of all the ramifications what that means.
What it means is that trial court employees and appellate court employees have the same status.
What is that status?
Exempt under that statute.
Yeah. I know that, but I'm trying to find out more about what that means in terms of the terms and conditions of their employment, their salaries, their working conditions, that kind of thing.
Their salaries are set by the compensation plan, which the Chief Justice put in place. Their work hours, et cetera, are set under the personnel rules, which the Chief Justice put in place pursuant to statute on January
1.
As I said, I didn't bring a copy of the rules, but I got them back in the office.
Well, ORS 8.235 says state court administrators appointed under 8.195, trial court clerks appointed under 8.215, and other non-judicial officers and employees of the circuit and district court who are appointed under a personnel plan established by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court are state officers or employees in the exempt service and not subject to ORS Chapter 240. That sounds like the same language here in Section 27.
I mean, we're trying to get them all together.
Okay. However, such personnel shall retain the right to be dismissed only for just cause after hearing an appeal.
That's
now,
the same as in line 19.
The way the law in the land is in Oregon right now is if a circuit court judge wants to hire somebody because he wants to hire them, they can do that. He or she can do that, as I understand it. There was a big issue and brouhaha about whether circuit court judges were going to be able to
hire their own secretaries and have discretion to do that. And they didn't feel they did under the way this was passed originally. And you're saying this is the statute that allows them to do it now, right?
No, the personnel rules allows them to do it. The personnel rules mandates that a supervisor hires, reviews the people or interviews the people who apply for a job and hires the best person. So that a trial court judge would hire his secretary and court reporter, a trial court clerk would hire the COS 2 who works under her, I hire personnel my fiscal rules director, the supervisor, standard merit system personnel.
Well, how was it that before that was passed, the way it was originally passed, that the judges thought they weren't going to be able to exercise that discretion?
Because that's what they thought. That was not the reality. They thought that I was going to hire their secretaries, and they didn't realize that I was not going to hire their secretaries. And I think most of them now realize that we never intended to hire their secretaries, that supervisors hire the people they supervise. And since they supervise their secretaries, they hire them, and have in the existing since January. And prior to January.
So what happens to a secretary who's working for a circuit court judge in X county, and the circuit court judge gets run over by a truck, and a new circuit court judge, or retires.
Secretary,
I don't want to use a gruesome example.
The new
judge is appointed, and he or she wants to bring the person out of their law office to hold that job because that person knows their wife's or their husband's birthday and all that, and they want them to be right there to do that. Now, what happens to that secretary who was working for the judge who's retired?
That secretary continues to work for the new judge unless proven to be incompetent and dismissed for just cause after hearing an appeal.
But that's not what happened when Justice Denneke retired, is it? And that was after January the 1st, wasn't it?
It happened when Judge Denneke retired.
His secretary was not allowed to stay on. And that would have been under the new personnel plan, wouldn't it?
His secretary retired prior. He retired and she retired prior to January 1. I'm talking January 1. He retired last July.
I don't remember for sure when it was. I thought it was after January the 1st.
No.
July.
No, he retired before the first of the year.
Judge Lent came on in July.
But I didn't go to the Supreme Court until December or January.
Mr. Chairman, do we want to redo the entire personnel plan? And if we do, let's take that up. I'd like to get the, if you don't mind, are we going to...
Are you going to hurry me now?
No, yes. I just want to know what your intentions are, because if we're going to review the personnel plan, then I want a copy of it, you know, so that we don't have to spend the time with it. I don't have any problem with doing it.
Until I fully understand the implications of this section.
Well, I understand the implications of the section. I don't understand what we're putting them into when we say we're putting them into what is current statute.
Well, that's what I mean. I think we need an explanation.
We need to find out what current statute is the personnel plan that was put in place on January 1. And if we want to spend time looking at it, if we want to talk about it, I'd like to have the personnel plan to know what that section really means and to be able to look at it ahead of time or whatever. So
I think that's a good idea.
So I can talk about it intelligently because otherwise I don't have, you know, we're just asking her kind of shotgun questions, which
I... If you want to continue with the rest of the bill and I can make a phone call, I can get you copies within 5 minutes.
Fine. Let's go ahead.
Excuse me. I need to make the phone call.
Maybe we can get the other hostile witnesses on the other side.
Well, we could. The only thing is, I think they're going
to
come up and testify about something that maybe is we need the information from her about before we...
Doesn't Kirk
could we
have a copy
somebody
of
to make the phone call?
Yeah,
I think he does.
Kirk has one. Plans. If I come up and do that.
Sure.
Okay. Kirk has a copy of it. There's one in the building.
So does Kay Hutchison. She has a copy.
Sam Gillespie, Oregon asked me here against the bill. Personnel plans, it's been tested in arbitration, court procedures, NLRB rulings, time again and again. You can have any kind of personnel plan that you want to have, and those cover exempted employees. But when you negotiate a collective bargaining agreement, they supersede any personnel plan. And the two court cases that the Court of Appeals...
Wait a minute now. You lost me already. You say you can have a personnel plan, and if you have what?
A collective bargaining agreement where that personnel plan dealing with the same subject matter in any area, sick leave, vacation, arbitration, grievance procedure, holidays, whatever you want to talk about, if you have a collective bargaining agreement, full force in effect, That supersedes any personnel plan that the state has, and in fact, that's the case where any of the state employees currently are represented by collective bargaining agreements. But in addition, in these sections 27 through 32, there are a number of things that are being taken away, the rights of these employees, by this bill, that it's our contention that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court can't do in the courts. And existing law already takes care of that in chapters 240 and particularly 243.
So you're putting them into 240, aren't you?
No, this says not subject to chapter 240.
That's right.
Are exempt employees allowed to collectively bargain?
The question gets under exempt employees. And in this section of 240 and in this bill, in sections 27 through 32, some people are exempted that normally wouldn't be exempted under ORS 243650, which is the state collective bargaining law.
Could you give us a list of those people or the kind of people we're talking about?
If I can show you the law,
currently
the law is in there because where it exempts under exempted employees, right here on page 11 of the bill, section 29, line 32, court reporters, bailiffs, other officers of the court are currently represented or were represented by AFSCME and Oregon Professional Employees Union in district and circuit courts. When they all become state employees, we interpret this to mean that they would be exempted from service. We have a problem with that.
Who is that?
Exempted from what service?
They would be exempted from collective bargaining.
Which ones would be?
Court reporters, bailiffs, and other officers of the court, which includes a lot of employees.
But isn't this taking that language out of the where this says, the exempt service shall comprise, colon, that references who is in the exempt service. It says judges.
Okay, so what you're saying then is they're deleting that.
They're deleting that.
Okay, then in that one regard, we may not have a problem with it. But on line 33, officers and employees of legislative assembly, as a matter of fact, the Capitol Police are employees of the legislative assembly and are represented by AFSCME under collective bargaining agreement. So we would have to change this exemption if that were the only problem, and there are hundreds of problems
isn't
with
that,
these sections.
Isn't that the existing law?
Yes.
Well, but then why are they under collective bargaining agreements? See,
well,
and I'm saying
they're employees of the executive department, is my guess.
No, they're legislative assembly employees.
Officers?
Excuse me, but this is a court bill. Can we deal with courts?
Well,
you're not the chairman here, Matt.
Oh, wait now. Let's get this unscrambled here. What we're going to do?
Now, call me when you decide.
Okay.
This is the existing law, as I read it, though, Mr. Chairman. This line 33. Line 32 is taking out.
Just a minute. I want to get this straightened out. How we're proceeding at the moment.
Okay.
We got two people here who are disagreeing.
Now,
Ms. Belshaw has said she'd like to have 5 minutes to go get this information about the rules. Now, on that hand, I don't know if you want to leave right now. If we're going to go on talking about this,
If I can make a phone call, I have one of my staff people bring it over. If I can just call my office and say, please bring them over.
All right. If you want to do it that way, or we can go on through the bill and come back to this.
Whatever you want to do, it's up to you.
Well, I think, why don't we give the information to, did Kathy go somewhere?
We went to try to get it.
Okay.
We might be able to locate it.
Here she comes. Why don't, is that the personnel?
Well, that's the large.
Is that
the
one
you? 11, we have a little one, but it's in there. If you'll just look under the section that's marked rules.
Okay.
There's a divider in there.
Would you hand that to the witness? And why don't you let her
that's
go
fine.
Ahead?
That's fine.
Thank you.
I think there's a conflict.
Okay, the table of contents for the personnel rules reads general provisions, and general provisions basically talks about the citation, which allows the Chief Justice to set up the personnel system, the purpose of the rules, and the authority for it. It lists who's going to be, it basically talks about supervisors being responsible for the people they supervise and that sort of thing. The next is the definition of terms, and that describes things such as what is the administrative authority, what's a probationary period, what's compensatory time, what's layoff. Then it goes to position classification, that is describing the job. What is a judicial assistant? The same way that you describe any job ordinarily under a personnel system. Compensation plan, equal employment opportunity and affirmative action, recruitment and selection, performance evaluation, grievance procedure, disciplinary action, appeal procedure, layoff and reemployment, resignation and retirement, hours of work, vacation leave, sick leave, other types of leave, holidays, transfer, nepotism, gifts, favors, outside employment, medical examinations, political activity, and employee records. Those are the rule numbers, and basically it contains the same thing most other personnel rules contain. And it's about 59 pages long.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hendricks.
It appears to me that we should get an opinion, I just mentioned this to counsel, because I am confused in terms of whether merely exempts them from Chapter 240, which is the civil service rules, or if it also carries over to Chapter 243, which is a collective bargaining. So I would like to have legislative counsel give us an opinion on that, if we could.
Well, if pursuant to 8.235, all those people are in the exempt service, which is, I guess, what we did in the special session, and if the Court of Appeals just said that they do have a right to bargain collectively, then that seems, I mean, a quick answer to the question is that that's
still. Well, but we don't know if that was a legal issue. I thought it was a separation. I thought they raised a constitutional issue that it was unconstitutional. So I still would like to know the.
I'll get a copy of it.
Whether this exempt service, what that means in terms of collective bargaining law.
Who raised what as being unconstitutional?
Well, I believe the Chief Justice took the position, and Ms. Belshaw can correct me if I'm wrong, that under the separation of powers doctrine, that the court, as a judicial branch and separate, was not, I guess, subject to the collective bargaining laws.
I am not speaking to that. It's in litigation, so I don't feel
that
free
wasn't
to
the opinion that came down, but that's not the opinion.
Well, I don't know. I'd like to see the opinion. I'd like to get a legal opinion. I'm certainly not going to act on this bill today.
And the opinion has come down on that already?
No.
Court of Appeals
decided whether Judge Erskine's opinion was correct.
I'm just curious when it goes to the Supreme Court how to handle it.
That's my understanding.
I would guess so.
At least there's one case out there that's been decided. I think it came out of Coos County, where the Chief Justice said that, I don't know, maybe they were employees of the juvenile department. Anyway, certain employees were not subject to collective bargaining because they're court employees and there's a separation of powers and all that. And that went to court, and the Coos County Circuit Court judge found otherwise. That's the way I remember it. That's one case.
Yeah.
Then there's the other one that happened here in Marion County.
Right. Well, there's one that just the Court of Appeals just yesterday or the day before gave out an opinion saying that it wasn't unconstitutional. But I suppose they'll appeal it.
The judge's part.
If this section...
Well, I think you have a good idea there, because I think that is the subject of concern here, and this we need to check out what... and I think we will follow up on that. No, excuse me, go ahead.
If sections 27 through 30 are a problem, I respectfully request that they be taken out of the bill, because if this bill does not pass, we cannot hold court in the new Justice Center, and so that is much more important than this section.
Either
an
idea.
Well, I wasn't saying we hold up to the end, but I certainly
would
not.
I move, Mr. Chairman, that we delete those sections.
Well, do we want to delete them before we find out whether they need to be deleted or not? I mean,
they seem to be of great concern. So,
where are you?
You're asking them in a separate vehicle.
Well, it's not like the session's going to end tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. I'd prefer to wait on that.
Well,
that might well be the solution, but I just.
Okay, I'll make the motion another day or so when we're still tangled up on this.
Well, I think it's a relatively, we just simply need a legal opinion, so we know, if it doesn't exempt them from collective bargaining, I have no problem with it. I just want to find out before I vote on it, you know.
Okay.
There's no need to have to put it out
like
today.
I said, I'll make my motion in 2 days. Okay.
Well, if you really want to make the motion, I'll take it.
I don't, because there's not enough votes to do it right now.
We're not going to be here on Saturday. You can't make it in 2 days.
Okay. I'll make it Monday, or Tuesday.
Yeah.
Sections 31 and 32 talk in terms of the State Court Administrator's Office being a repository for circuit and district court rules. and that we would provide those rules to people for whatever cost is necessary to publish the rules upon request. And this was put in at the request of the bar, and it makes a lot of sense to us because it basically says that we will have a master file of certain district court rules, so if an attorney in Grants Pass, for example, wants to know what the rules are in Pendleton, we can provide those to the attorney or to the general public or whoever. And this allows and specifies that we will be the repository for those rules. Any questions about that? Section 33 and through 35 straightens out a bifurcation of district that we have in the district court. The way it's set up now, we have a district court in Umatilla County, which has court locations at Milton, Freewater, and Pendleton, and then we have one for Umatilla and Morrow counties, which have locations in Hermiston and Hefner. So we now have judges who have two districts dividing up one county. And this was an anomaly done, a few strange things. It was put in place, I think, in the mid-1970s, and it messes up our statistics in terms of trying to get a handle on what each county does in the district court. So what we have done is basically allow those two judges to handle things in Umatilla and Morrow counties without this bifurcation and separating part of Umatilla into one district and part into another. This solves that problem. It really consolidates the Umatilla County District Court. Any questions about
it? Well, let's see now. Does
it's clear they weren't subject to Chapter 243 and also the Constitution.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frye.
The way I read this language on page 14, Umatilla County is going to have one more judge. Is that correct?
No, it's going to have, it's only got, there'll be the same number of district court judges as there are now. It merely allows them to be a pool of two judges instead of being a judge here and a judge there, both in the same, dividing up Umatilla County.
Okay, I see.
Instead of dividing Umatilla County so that Hermiston is serviced by a judge who covers Morrow and Umatilla counties, and then Pendleton and Milton Freewater are covered by this judge, it makes them a pool of two judges to cover the whole thing.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's flexibility in terms of scheduling is what it is. Any other questions on that?
Well, let's see. We're still talking about sections 31 and 32?
We're talking 33 and 35 in regard to Umatilla and Morrow counties.
Yeah.
I think.
Could I go back just a minute? Without, I happened to be out when you went through 31 and 32, and I just had a. My understanding now of court rules are really the rules that govern a lawyer's conduct, pretty much. But
no, these are rules of court, how cases will be filed. These are local rules of court, such as the ones that they have in Lane County, which tell an attorney basically how to practice within the circuit district court down there. That's the kind of rules they're talking about here.
Okay, the kind of rules referred to here. If they just refer to the kind of court rules that I'm familiar with, like the Lane County Rules
That's
of Court,
it
doesn't have anything to do with like personnel rules or work rules of people.
No, this is merely rules of court, and it just makes our office a repository so that an attorney or anybody else can find all the rules of all the courts in one location. That's its purpose.
Okay.
If they exist. If the court hasn't passed any rules, we don't have them.
Mm-hmm.
Section 30, can we go on to Section 36? Section 39.
Sure.
Okay, what this does is allows us to make the distribution of legal aid fees and library fees when we make the distribution of the BPST and the local fees to local police departments in the counties, which cannot, under the existing system, because of support and various other things, be done in the 10 days. It also allows us to just send the money directly to the law library, to the legal aid people, under our existing automated system. The problem is that we have an automated accounts payable system, and we have to run everything through that system. Otherwise, we do manual checks, and the volume of this allows us doing manual checks. So this basically allows us to make the distribution of monies taken in at one time in the month to everybody at the same time, rather than having to do the law libraries within the first 10 days and do the police and the counties in the last 10 days. Makes for uniformity and flexibility in terms of us not having to try to get support checks out at the same time we're trying to do law library checks. Section 40 to 53 straightens out some confusion. The way our automated system is built, we write a check for BPST and send it directly to BPST. The way the law is written, it requires that everything goes to the Department of Revenue. both revenues that come in. I'm sorry, this applies to revenues that come in. Right now, in the trial courts, an individual pays a fine, and at the end of each day, those fines, fees, et cetera, are deposited directly into the general fund. The way the law is written now, we would have to turn that money over to the Department of Revenue, and then they would deposit it in the general fund, which means it would not get into the general fund as quickly as it does now. So with it acquiescing in the Department of Revenue, we have changed the law so that we can just do daily deposits directly into the general fund.
What would happen if... Why wouldn't it be more efficient to have the money deposited? Is this the fine money in the counties?
It's fines, fees, all the money taken in the courts.
Why wouldn't it be more efficient for them to handle the money there in the county rather than coming to Salem and going back?
Because the state doesn't get the benefit of that money.
Couldn't it be state money but just deposited locally?
Well, the state has, it is deposited to local banks, but what you're talking about is a depository that is local. And then a check writing process, which is also local. That's what you're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the Chief Justice made a decision that the money would go into the state pot, deposit a local bank, but into the state general fund immediately. Okay, he also made a decision that the checks would be written out of our office. Now, part of the reason for that is that on January 1, 1983, we picked up the employees tied to
it appears to me that, I mean, there is implicit in this holding, in the Lent opinion, where Berkeley Lent is the plaintiff appellant, is a holding that they are indeed subject to 243. That appears to be what that is holding.
So far.
But we don't want to, by this bill,
yes,
overturn that opinion.
Yeah, precisely.
But it won't.
But we don't know that,
it
though.
Won't under that. Right?
But then we don't know what the Supreme Court's going to do, ultimately.
That's a different question. But, I see the question. Okay.
But Betsy Belshaw is saying, certainly not their intent to. Now, we're going to look into what the actual legal effect of the language might be, but it's pretty clear that this isn't a plan to try and torpedo something.
Right.
Apparently, these Court of Appeals employees
hear you.
Thank you.
Are not exempt now. They are now under the Civil Service Rules of 240.
Well, again,
they've never been under them in actuality. They're treated. They have been, every time you look at anything, the court employees, the appellate court employees have been state employees for a long time. And in terms of their payroll and how they're handled and how they were dealt with in regard to personnel rules and all the rest of that, they were never included in the executive branch system, per se, in terms of how they were treated. And so I don't know how they're designated in terms of unclassified except for the rest of it. But
were they considered confidential
they
employees of the court? I mean, were any of them, are any of them in collective bargaining units?
The appellate court employees? No.
Yeah. But the other concern, I think, is the fact that, if I may, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is that we have a new situation, obviously. And I think that maybe some of the existing statutes, I'll refer back to what I stated earlier, may now be inappropriate, if you will, because they are exempting employees, and I'm not throwing any stones or pointing any fingers. What I'm saying is existing statutes may be in need of change to get up to speed, if you will, with what the people decided by putting the state courts under.
Would anybody mind if I sound a little bit like Deb Potts for a minute here? Now, what I'd like to do now, and I think we can all come to understand this if we all just have a day or so to look at it. We're going to ask legislative council about it, and we're going to go away from here and think about what we've heard today and seen, and we're going to hear from Brother Fletcher Benediction on this bill for today.
Prepared statement that's written out, and I'll go away. I'll go immediately to the fairgrounds and get a jump on everything.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, members are left of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'm Irv Fletcher, President of the Oregon AFL-CIO. My opposition to House Bill 2364 is based on what appears to be a denial of the application of the state collective bargaining law for employees of the tax appellate and Supreme Court. The employees I am concerned about are those who, if employed by the executive branch of government, would enjoy the rights, benefits, and privileges accorded to bargaining unit employees. The actions of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the past several months indicate that he does not believe those employees should be covered by the state collective bargaining law. We in the Oregon AFL-CIO disagree with him. Whatever you ultimately do with respect to this bill, you meaning the committee members, we believe the legislature should enact legislation clearly stating the right of all state employees to be included under state public employee collective bargaining law. That's the statement I want to make before this committee, and I think that needs to be cleared up. And I think by asking for the opinion in Section 27, it probably will clear it up for you, so you'll know where these people are at.
And again, if I might, the only thing that I would request is that we would also, on any opinion that might be requested, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that the specific question would also be asked with the specific statutes that are referred to in Sections 27 through 32 in House Bill A and Gross 2364. Are they still applicable to the situation since we have changed the way we're going to run our state courts? And I think that's a very appropriate question, because otherwise what I will have to do is come back and we'll have to go through this piece by piece, and particularly the one that legislative officers and employees of legislative assembly, I understand that that's existing statute, but in the last 2 years, we now represent legislative assembly employees in the form of the Capitol Police, okay? So I would think that if nothing else, if all this were okay, I would have to ask you to delete that from existing statute because it doesn't apply. And if your legislative aides and clerical support staff are exempt from service, I would have to argue whether we would represent them and anyone else, that that should also that prohibition, if this is what line 33 of section 29 does, page 11, should also be repealed, because those employees should have the right if they independently choose to do that. And that's clearly been outlined to other landmark Supreme Court cases and backed up by both Court of Appeals cases. One was heard 2 days ago before the Supreme Court, the infamous Barron Coos County case, Marion County Court case. What Justice Lent does as the mover on that case will be his decision. And in the meantime, we have 850 to 1,100 court employees are being held hostage to the process, and we've already been certified, as I stated before, for statewide court election.
Senator Gardner.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in particularly Sam's observation about, when you look at Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, you'll notice that Congress conveniently exempted itself from the coverage of it. It's really, but I do think if we do that, and if we say we were to legislatively clarify what this opinion holds, which is that 243 applies to the state court employees, which we certainly could do and put an end to this controversy, I think it holds that already. And then say we were to add legislative employees to 243, I think we ought to do that in a separate vehicle.
That's fine. I'm happy to do that. But we certainly don't have any objection. Maybe the Supreme Court justice would be of the opinion that he could support that then.
Senator Hendricks.
Well, I just think the other point you raised is, and I was trying to remember when I was county attorney, because maybe the courts didn't make personnel rules through their rulemaking authority, because there was always a conflict between the county commissioners.
Chugging down the track pretty good.
Not only in terms of fiscal terms, but who was really in charge of the personnel.
That's right.
And maybe next time we hear this, Ms. Belshaw can comment on that with respect to whether those rules could in any indicate any be used not only just for rules of court, procedure, but also for personnel.
Okay, and I thank you. And Senator Wires, if you happen to see Senator Cohen before I do, and I will personally extend my apology if I offend her anyway. It certainly wasn't my intent. Okay? Thank you.
You're welcome. We should have, I want to leave here soon, but I would like to have a public hearing on House Bill 2459, 2390, 2537, 2969, and 2536 today. And you're the only witness on each of them.
Isn't there someone on 2459?
2459, is there someone in the audience that wanted to testify on that? there's only one person signed up.
I don't know what you're doing. Oh, well.
Senator Hanby.
What kind of votes again?
We've got Government Operations Committee scheduled for next Tuesday, and there's a bill here that the President and the Chair of the Revenue Committee would like to see be in Government Operations Committee. Senator Gardner is very concerned about that its contents not get lost by its House Bill 2185.
That forestry or reforestation.
Yeah. Senator Hanlon has represented to me that he has vehicles in his revenue committee that could have House Bill 2185's contents put in, and that we could that way be sure it got on through the process. Senator Gardner has a bit of a bird in the hand philosophy on the subject.
Yeah.
I don't want to do all these
talking. I'm on all three committees. I'll follow it tenaciously.
Yeah, I'm not going to vote to send it there, but that's fine. I think you may have the votes to do that anyway. I want to pass the. I think that the forestry revision bill ought to be passed. It ought to be explored in a, you know, an appropriate vehicle coming out of that committee, which I assume they're devoted to do, and that this non-controversial bill ought to be sent out on its own merits. But that's just my sense on it.
I did some checking since our last conversation on it, discussion on it, and I tend to hang on to the reforestation issue. I've got a lot of, you know, timber in western Washington County, and it is, I'm much more comfortable acting on it here, Jan. I'm sorry.
Okay. Senator Brown's out of town.
Senator Brown.
Brown's out of town. The problem of it is that the meeting's coming up next Tuesday, and so if we don't do it today, we won't be able to.
Well, could you call a special judiciary committee? Walt's going to be back.
Do it on the floor. You can call
it. Oh, God,
on
the floor. I hate to do that. You can do it, but.
Looks like that's about the choice.
Well.
Or is Walt going to be back tomorrow?
No, not till Monday. Senator Hanlon says that he's very confident that he can get that language out of a bill out of his committee.
How soon?
Right away. He's got absolutely no reservations about House Bill 2185.
We've got plenty of time and Senate revenue to do that, too. Our workload is rather light at the moment.
Why do you need to go?
We meet tomorrow.
Could they do it tomorrow? I'd feel far more comfortable.
Well, except it's 5 o'clock.
But then we can't,
meet,
we
the
can't meet tomorrow.
No,
and I'm going to leave.
Are we on the emergency meeting time yet?
I don't think so. And I'm going to leave at 2 o'clock tomorrow. I've got to go to Portland tomorrow. I'm usually here till after 5 on Fridays, but I won't be tomorrow. Can I get one of you two to cast Walt Brown's vote for me?
Where's Joyce? Is she still in the building, or will she vote for
me? She is. I could go up and find her. I was working on another bill. I could go up and find her. Or maybe,
I doubt if she's in the mood to do this either at this point.
When does revenue
can I help out?
Friday, tomorrow.
Are you trying to get some motion passed?
I'm trying to get House Bill 2185 sent back to the desk so the President can reassign it to Government Operations.
So did you send out for a vote
or
something?
Well, I can't speak for him.
Yeah.
Hmm?
Well, I asked him. Yeah. I feel more comfortable if I knew the issue were out.
Could we talk to him now and see if he'd get a commitment he could put on the agenda tomorrow?
I would vote against it.
Against sending it?
Yeah.
Well, see, you got Bill Frye will vote against sending it, too.
That's why I was wondering why you wanted to bother getting Joyce.
Oh, you should have mentioned it.
Oh, I thought you were okay on doing that.
Well, I was until Jim Gardner just got through saying that he felt that it was more important to send this thing out. Is that the way Senator Hanby feels?
The reason that they want the bill in this committee is so they can get a House vehicle to send it back directly for concurrence. And, you know, I understand that concern. I
have real concerns about this bill getting intertwined in that exchange process. And it is a very important, very non-controversial bill, which might be used, either might get lost or might be used as a lever in that process, to be real candid. And
well, how would it be if we Senators Hendricks and I, both of whose votes are necessary to get that forestry bill out of government op, told you that we wouldn't move it out of government op until the contents of 2185 have gotten to the Senate floor? Would that be good enough?
Well, I guess
it's
I don't
strictly a timing problem.
Yeah.
We can do it unless you think it's a very important vote for you on the record, because we'll be able to do it next week, and what you will have done by making us wait would have been to have put off by a week getting started on this major forestry bill.
Because
we can do it anyway.
I think you can get started on the forestry bill, you know, independently on the substance of it, prepare amendments or whatever, without, you know, before you have the thing in hand. I'm just I guess not feeling totally secure that this bill, you know, what I want to do, in fact, what I would do if there was another person here is I'd request that there be a hearing set for this particular bill in this committee so we can maybe take a vote on it.
Eliminating it as a possible vehicle.
Well,
all righty. Well, we won't be able to move on that today. Why don't we have a, the forestry bill is not one of my top priorities this session by a long shot, but it's just a matter of I'm trying to accommodate Senator Hamlin.
I understand that.
And the president, who said that he wants to do it this way. And
well, I'll vote for it then.
I told Senator Hanlon I wouldn't do it until he checked with the president. And so what it really comes down to is a practical matter, unless it's a big point to you to be able to be recorded voting no, is that by your refusing to do this now, you make us wait till next week, and we'll do it then.
Fine.
Okay.
Well, I'll vote with you to send it out. I don't know a thing about either bill you're talking about. I'm just trying to...
Yeah, this isn't a hearing on a bill.
If the president wants it to be handled this way, and if you want it to be handled
Joyce
this way...
Joyce is coming now.
I'll go along with it, but I am concerned about Senator Gardner's concern, whatever it is, and I...
It is that the bill that's a non-controversial bill, House Bill 2185, which does some things for certain people, I'm not even aware exactly who it is, has to do with reforestation, I think.
Clarifies who has the obligation to perform reforestation and makes it clear it's the landowner that has that obligation.
Well, listen,
That he's afraid that in working around with this, the contents of this non-controversial bill will die in the process.
Well, I perceive that Senator Gardner does not want to put other senators and other committees in a position that he might put them in, but at the same time, he's not willing to back off, and I think that's a point of view that I respect, and therefore I'm going to help him out in this respect. I'm going to eliminate the possibility that there can be any lingering effects of his unwillingness now by voting along with the three other people to send this thing out.
It's got enough votes.
Plus, Mr. Chair.
Well, it depends on whether Jeanette's willing to do it or not.
Well,
it
Joyce is enough. Coming.
No, Joyce
is
on
her
way.
I would think that Senator Hanlon, who from the district he comes from, would be very concerned that the original bill and its content get out.
Possibly.
I'd hope so.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's pretty important to his district, you know.
So we use the Depp-Potts approach in this, too?
No. But Jeanette, would you be willing to do this to save us waiting till Tuesday?
Oh, I can't. I'm a good conscience. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, let's start hearing House Bill from Ms. Belshaw, whichever order you want to comment on the remaining five bills.
We just heard it. There's some problems with it.
Bill 2390.
2390, okay. House Bill 2390.
We put in place in January an automated fiscal system, which means that the data is entered into the computer in our office, and that results in a check being written in the data systems department. That check is taken down to the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue sends the checks out for us so that the system is pretty well automated from start to finish. The way the law is written, or we would have to go through the Executive Department accounting system and do a manual voucher without the passage of this bill. This bill allows us to write the check directly in the computer and get it paid by the state treasurer without going through the manual voucher system in the executive branch, which allows for an okay by the treasurer. They have, since January, allowed us to do this by their good graces by setting up a temporary revolving fund, which allows us to put money into a fund which they draw against when they write the checks, since the state treasurer is a banker. Without this bill, we can't continue that process, and so it's very important that we have the revolving fund, which is agreeable to the state treasurer, and allow $1 million to go in that fund on a regular basis so that we can write checks against it to pay all our operating support, indigent defense contracts, everything. It's a technical change that needs to be put in place, and it is agreed to by the state treasurer's office.
Okay. No negative testimony?
Pardon me?
Is there any negative testimony on that?
No, there isn't.
I just have a question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hendrickson.
On these House amendments, what was their effect from the original bill?
We originally started out thinking we could do with $500,000. Four times a year, we write checks to indigent defense contractors that come to more than $500,000, so we were afraid that we'd be short in the fund without raising the limit to $1 million. And that is also agreed to by the state treasurer.
Okay, House Bill 2459.
You don't want a motion now on this?
No. Okay. All right.
Do you want to go back to your original, since Senator Pope's here? I can wait.
Do you want to hear the testimony on these bills anyway?
I can read if you're saying, I don't want you to go back over testimony.
No, this isn't going back over. Okay, since we stopped,
I'll do whatever
anyway, what we asked you to come down for was that...
All right, I'm here for the rest until 7 o'clock if you want it.
Okay, I think we'll be done here in another 10 or 15
minutes.
You guys
are partying.
I've got to go to Portland. Plus, I am really tired today. But... Senate bill, House bill, where is it? Where's the number of it? There's a House bill here in the committee that you may have been
talking
about. You may have heard something about in the last few days. We talked about this a couple of days ago. House Bill 2185 that doesn't have any opponents that I'm aware of, and passed the House, obviously, and says that the landowner has the responsibility for reforesting their land when it's cut. And Senator Hanlon has requested that we move this bill back to the desk to be reassigned to another committee. And he's asked the President of the Senate if he would reassign to the Operations Committee because he wants to try to get the forestry bill that he and Senator McFarland been working very hard on and thought they had agreements made within the industry and with the governor that could be supported. It's in a House bill. Those agreements have somehow gone sour, and so he wants, due to the composition of the House committees, I think he thinks he'll have trouble getting it through there with their wonderful parity rule or whatever they call it. So he wants to have this bill moved up to government operations. He's gotten the President to agree to that, and the problem is that there are five of us here. There were four of us here, and Senator Gardner is very concerned, as are, I think, all the members of the committee concerned, that we don't want to lose the provisions that are in 2185. So if it went up to government operations and put the forestry bill in it, if somewhere along the line that bill got hung up or vetoed or something or another, God forbid, 2185's contents would be lost. So that was how far we got the last time we discussed this, I think on Tuesday. This week early. We've now scheduled the Government Operations Committee next Tuesday. The schedule is such that it's very difficult for that committee to meet more than like once a week. So if we don't move this bill today, we won't be able to hear it next week, and then it'll be at least a week more before it can be worked on. Senator Hanlon has said that he has bills in the Senate Revenue Committee, House bills, that he sure has relating clauses on this bill to put into. I have said that I would be willing to say that I wouldn't vote to send that forestry bill out until the contents of this bill have been voted out of the Revenue Committee. That's the question.
My concern is, Mr. Chairman, that that other bill, which is a very, it's an essential bill, it is a non-controversial bill, not become a hostage or a whatever in that the debate over the forestry board composition bill, and that it not be, you know.
I haven't heard anybody say that they would consider making. I haven't heard anybody say that they would consider making this a hostage.
Well,
I think the reason this bill was picked is purely because it had a relating clause. But as you know, and we all know, anything's possible in this process.
So that's why I'm going to vote no on that motion to send it to that committee. And you're here because you would be the
first
vote.
I'm here because I'll vote with the chair if that's your choice.
No, I just thought of something.
Senator Fry.
Your Government Operations Committee meets once a week?
Well, it met twice this week. I guess all I can say is it's difficult to schedule that committee.
But it is going to meet on Tuesday.
It is going to meet on Tuesday. We're scheduled to meet on Tuesday, and it's my present plan that would be the only meeting we would have next week.
Would you advise me, I'm not asking you to make any commitment on voting for it, but I just want you to assure me that the bill that I testified on last week will come up for a vote at that meeting.
You see what I mean?
All I want. Just vote on it. You can vote it down if you want.
I rest my case.
What bill are you talking about, Senator Fry?
Veterans preference.
Veterans preference.
Oh,
these bills have a funny way of acquiring baggage, don't they?
Freshmen have a funny way of learning fast. Certain things here.
Do you want that? Do you want that in writing?
I don't know.
No, I'm
just teasing. Yes, I'll do that.
Okay, fine. Go ahead.
And the vice chair has agreed that that would be all right with her too. All right. There's somebody not in the room is not going to be happy. Oh boy. Okay. The chair now moves House Bill 2185.
With baggage.
To the desk.
Three suitcases.
For reassignment, I think is the language.
I know you don't name the committee. I think you just move it to the desk.
It's up to the president to do that. Okay. If there's no further discussions or codicils, would you please call the roll?
Cohen.
Aye.
Fry.
Aye.
Gardner.
No.
Hamby.
No.
Hendrickson.
Aye.
Wires.
Aye. Motion carried. Senator Cohen, while you were gone, the chair apologized to
Betsy
for the outburst, and the person who made the outburst, Mr. Gillespie, apologized to the committee and to Ms. Bill.
I'm not averse to discussing the issue. Or to even reworking that, whether they ought to be exempt or not. I just felt it was...
Well, I think it was a matter of somebody not having had the benefit of some legal counsel on it, and the committee, too. We're going to get the legislative counsel to try and help us. This is a mixed-up area at the moment, but I think we're all in agreement we'll be able to work it out. Let's see, we just finished on 2390. Now, would 2459 be the next one? Just going mathematically.
2459, the purpose of this bill is to straighten out some problems also that developed in regard to the transition. It appears that there were some people who thought that the law was very clear in regard to what would happen to revenues in the court, that, for example, in the case of a fine, the fine was imposed in 1982 but collected in 1983. Some of the counties took the position that if the fine was imposed in 1982, collected in 1983, that it should go to them. we took the position that it was imposed in 1982, collected in 1983, it should go to us. So Section 1 straightens that out and basically says that those counties which went ahead and collected the fees for the first 4 months, because the Chief Justice was waiting for the legislature to make a decision on this and said, okay, if you inform us that you're going to collect it, go ahead and collect it. This allows them to keep the money that they collected to April 1st, but after that, we get everything. And those counties which did not collect anything between January 1 and April 1 would not be able to go back and collect it. So this straightens out a transition confusion that some people thought existed, and basically said those revenues go to the state from now on.
I don't see anybody from the counties here signed up against this, so
this
it
was
must be
both
compromise.
This was worked out with them, yes.
Mr. Chairman, the county clerk of Douglas County, which is a part of which is in my district, is very, very concerned over this bill, and I have a letter. I've discussed this with her by telephone, but as I understand it from her argument, the Chief Justice and the County Clerk of Douglas County entered into a contract, and the contract was that the Douglas County people could retain these proceeds until July the 1st. And so naturally she thinks that there's somebody's reneging on this contract.
There's no contract to the best of my knowledge.
What about do you have a copy of the consent decree, Senator Frye, that the commissioners from the county, Douglas County, signed?
A consent decree?
You should all have copies of the papers. There's a lot of correspondence that went back and forth between Justice Lent and the...
Puts this proposed letter of agreement here, too.
That basically said you can go ahead, since there's confusion, you can go ahead and collect them until it's resolved.
And what you indeed did was reward the people that went ahead and collected it under this bill by letting them keep the money.
We did. The House Judiciary Committee did. The
original
recommendation was to get it all back. That was our recommendation. This is a compromise that was worked out.
Okay, then when I say you, I would say the parties to the compromise is working out.
Right. Mm-hmm. We have always been of the position that
you didn't get
that statement.
Douglas County signed off on that compromise.
Well, the Association of Counties, the Association of Oregon Counties worked out the compromise. No, I don't know. You'd have to ask Mr. Orrick, but this was agreeable to the Association of Oregon Counties, to the best of my knowledge.
Well, we aren't going to act on this bill today, then. We'll take time to get feedback from that distant backside of the state.
Well, it was my understanding that at some point there were 14 counties that had entered into agreements like this. Are you saying that all those other counties have agreed to give up the funds between April and July?
Best of my knowledge.